All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks so much for being here. I'm Greg Dixon. I'm the chair of the Pacific Northwest section of the AES. And I also work in Redmond, Washington, as assistant professor of music and sound design at DigiPen Institute of Technology. I'd like to welcome everybody here to our first ever online meeting of the section. And I thank you once again for being here. We are going to continue to meet virtually until it is safe for our membership to meet in person once again. The coronavirus has changed our world very drastically in the past few months. I'd like to recognize that this is a difficult time for many of us. I'd like to encourage those of us who are able to find ways to extend support and generosity to people who are in need. I'd also like to encourage those of us who do need help right now to reach out and let people know. The Pacific Northwest section of the AES is one of the things that I truly cherish about living in this area. For me, having the opportunity for us to continue to meet together provides me with a great sense of comfort, and I'm thankful for the AES right now for the camaraderie and unity that it can help provide. I'm also very thankful that our virtual meeting provides a way for members of our Pacific Northwest section and other members and non-members who may live well outside of Seattle an opportunity to attend and participate in our meeting. It is great to see so many of your new faces. We welcome you and old faces as well. We welcome you and look forward to meeting with you and getting to know you all better. I look forward to making the most out of what we can do with these tools that we have. To that end, I would like to give a special thanks to Dan Mortensen and also to our committee for all helping us lead the charge into this wild and strange virtual meeting world. I'd also like to extend thanks to Steve Turnage, who has been a consistent source of help and support for our section as we adapt to virtual meetings. I'd like to extend a thank you also to Bill Gibson, who will be helping us moderate questions this evening. In addition, I would like to extend a thank you to the University of Washington for helping us sponsor this Zoom meeting. Next month, we hope to be able to meet once again. I'm waiting on a confirmation, and I hope that we will have more meeting details coming soon. In addition, this June, we will be having our annual election, and we currently have a slate of candidates running for various positions. I'm going to announce the current status of the slate as follows. Chair, Greg Dixon. Vice Chair, Bob Smith. Secretary, Gary Louie. Treasurer, Lawrence Schwedler. Committee Member 2, Bill Gibson. Committee Member 4, Steve Kirk. Committee Member 6, Kathleen Gray. Committee Member 8, Jim Rondinelli. Committee Member 10, Matt Stearns. If you're a member of the AES and would like to consider running for a committee member position or would like to nominate someone to be a committee member, please feel free to do so. You may do so now if anybody wants to make a nomination. Another thing that we can do is if anybody wants to send me an email at greg.dixon@digipen.edu, I'll put that in the chat after I talk. But I'd also like to take a moment or two to just extend that and open up that discussion if anybody would like to nominate anyone or would like to make a nomination.
And Greg, that can also happen at the meeting in June when we have the election. It doesn't need to happen beforehand. It can, but it doesn't have to.
Thank you for that clarification, Dan.
Sure.
Greg?
Yeah.
Rick here. Paul Colvin emailed and expressed an interest in running for the committee.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks for that new info, Rick. Cool. Okay. So at this point, I need to address a few things of a technical nature regarding the Zoom meeting. First, we will have specifically allotted times for questions tonight, roughly every 20 minutes. We value everyone's thoughts and feedback, but unfortunately, the meeting risks becoming quickly disorganized if everyone is able to chime in with their microphones. For that reason, we are mandating that the attendees mute their microphones during the talk outside of allotted question time. Attendees are welcome to ask questions at any time using the Zoom chat, and our moderator, Bill Gibson, will help forward those questions on to Dan. The microphone mute button is on the lower left corner of your Zoom window, and if you need to access the chat, it is in the bottom middle portion of the window. Are there any other technical details that I may have left out?
Nope. You did good.
Okay, cool. Now I'd like to introduce our speaker this evening, Dan Mortensen, a live sound expert and owner and operator of the live sound company, Dan Sound. Recently, Dan gave a presentation to our section about his extensive research into CBS Records 30th Street Studio in New York City. Our section's friend, Frank Glaco, worked at 30th Street during its entire life from 1948 to 1981. Fellow committee member Bob Smith and Dan helped Frank tell his story to us at multiple meetings over several years, for which Frank won the AES's highest award given to non-members, the Honorary Member Award. At this time, I'd like us all to welcome Dan Mortensen.
Thank you. Your applause is deafening, and I appreciate it. And just a second here. There we go. Welcome, everybody, and thank you. That was really nice, Greg. It has really been an adventure getting this video stuff to work. And it's been, as I mentioned before, the switcher that I got and the gizmo that goes with the switcher doesn't fool a computer at all into thinking it's a camera. So you can't see my thumbnail when I'm not sharing full screen here with you. And I appreciate your patience with that. This meeting is going to be a mix of me live talking with slides, plus edited video recordings that I've made to show you more than I could show you in a reasonable time period about what I'm going to talk to you about. And I cut out all of the pauses that I have in those things, so you're not going to hear it the way I'm talking now, but I was trying to sound like those guys who do the funny car race and BMX motocross ads, where it just goes on like crazy and there goes one from one thing to the next. And so if you'll listen to it in that vein, I would appreciate it. And I just want to point out too that it's extremely odd being on both sides of the camera at once. There's no crew here really. I'm doing all the switching and stuff, so you'll see me looking over to see what needs to happen next, and I apologize for that. Usually our meetings go for about 3 hours altogether, and that seems to be painless. We decided that this thing needed to be in shorter bursts. So it's going to be roughly an hour and a half total, not counting questions, and I hope you do ask questions. And I wanted to say that it's entirely likely that I will misstate some important fact. In one of the videos, I say something about an XLR being wired so that there's one ground and two ungrounded pins. And in fact, what I meant was unbalanced signals, two unbalanced signals. So when you hear that eventually later, remember that. But if you would correct me to Bill, and Bill will ask me or tell me stuff gently. So this is going to go, like I said, about an hour and a half, and there'll be a question and answer break about every 20 minutes or so. And at the second one of those, we'll extend it out so that it's 15 more minutes so that you can get up and do whatever you want to and go get the cookies. So all of what I'm going to tell you is what I've found to be right for me and my workflow, but it may not be right for you. All of us know that there's more than one right way to do sound. And I hope that maybe you'll see something that will either encourage you to do something different and take it to someplace else, or to affirm that you're doing it right now. So now I'm going to do an introduction. And I wanted to tell you that, where's my doggone thing? This is what it is. Dance Sound Inc. is an Apple and Behringer Midas centric house. So my experience is with iPads, Airport Expresses, but some Linksys routers and Macs. I've tried to keep this general and platform agnostic, but I find that I'm often saying, when I mean tablet, I'm saying when you grab your iPad or whatever, and you should interpret that as meaning more generic than I intend it to be. And in full disclosure, Dance Sound Inc. is a dealer for both Midas and Behringer, but I don't think that this is any kind of sales deal, and I'm not expecting anybody to buy anything. I'd be astonished if anybody bought anything. So I'm going to tell you my wedding gig story, and it's not about my wedding. It's about a gig that I did. And this is relevant because all of the stuff that I'm going to show you is somewhat as a result of what happened to me, this event, and my trying to figure out what the hell that was all about. So anyway, it was these people got married in their backyard on their patio. Actually, they were in the yard. They had a band on their patio, and the patio was kind of next to this garage. At the time, the only Behringer digital console that existed was the full-size one. So it's about 3 feet wide, and in its case, over 100 pounds or so. And the only place to put that thing during the event was in their garage, which was kind of behind the band and down some stairs, but easy to get to with the vehicle, obviously. And I decided that that would be a great time to try out this newfangled tablet control of the console. So I ran a power cable from there with a cat cable up through the door and laid the Airport Express on the concrete wall that was there and out of the way of everybody. And we did a sound check. Oh, I should tell you where my mix position was. There was just enough room right next to the main door into the kitchen from the patio, which is where everybody is going to go in and out throughout the thing. There was just enough room on one side of it to put a road case with the iPads. Somebody's mic is on. With these iPads on top of the road case, with me to be there to mix them. And I had 3 iPads because there was 20 some inputs for the show. And I don't like doing the layers as much. I like being able to reach for something and grab it. I'm still in the analog world that way. If those of you who've mixed on digital tablets or consoles know that there's a lot of layers. There's way more features. So the same control can do a different thing at different times. Anyway, there was enough space right there for me to do my thing, and the sound check went great. The first 2/3 of the show went fabulous, maybe even 3/4. And about at that moment where it stopped going great, I was looking at the 3 iPads, and every one of them lost the symbol that tells you that it's connected to the console. It's like, oh man, okay, what do I do? You should know that when that happens with any of these consoles, when you lose control, the console stays working in the state that it was in when it stopped working. So nothing shuts off, nothing changes drastically. But if you had left something off or on that shouldn't be off or on, you're not going to be able to change it if you're on the iPad that is not connected. So I'm frozen there going, well, do I run to the garage and worm my way through the band while they're playing and get into this place where I can neither see nor hear? And what do I do once I'm there? I can't see or hear anything. or do I stay here and hope that it comes back? So I thought about that for about 3 hours, and that was actually in 10 seconds in real time, but it felt like 3 hours. So at the end of that 3 hours, I looked at the iPads and the three lights came back on to be connected, and the rest of the show went fine. So nobody knew anything happened and it was fine, but I was petrified and wanting to know what happened there. So that's in part where all of this stuff that I'm going to show you comes from. So first, let's look at the meaning of this phrase, mixing on glass. What does that mean? I've come up with two possibilities. One of them is using a wireless cordless tablet or other similar handheld device to control all the operational parameters of a digital mixing console, which has any form factor. And we'll get to what I mean by that in a second here. Location of that handheld device can be anywhere in the room as desired by the operator. Okay, so here's an example of 1 through 6, numbers 1 through 6 consoles here. Those are all essentially the same console. They have the same capabilities. They're all 32 mic pre inputs, if you have the right outboard gear for the smaller ones. There's 16 outputs. There's a bunch of aux in and a bunch of aux out, and then two Ethercon connectors that go to either stage boxes or other consoles. So let's examine the form factors here. 1 and 2 each have, those are full-size consoles, and they each have 16 input sliders that are switchable in banks between to get to your 32 channels. And those are always input channels, I believe. The next 8 faders on either to the right are always output faders. And then there's a bunch of other stuff on these consoles. The number 3 and 4 have 16 faders, 2 banks of 8, and each bank of 8 can be either inputs or outputs, depending on how you set it up. There's 16 built-in mic pre's and connectors on the back, but you can add an outboard stage box to get up to 32, so it's the same features as 1 and 2. 5 and 6, and 3 and 4 can also be rack mounted. You can put rack mount ears on those. So that's how wide they are. They fit in a rack. So 5 and 6 are specifically rack mount. There's no faders on them. 5 has some controls on it, and you could do a show, mix a show on that, and people have, but it's much more convenient to have some kind of control surface. And it still has 32 ins and outs, or 32 ins and 16 outs. And number 6 has no physical controls for all intents and purposes. And you have to have some kind of control surface, whether it's a computer or a tablet. Number 7 is a different duck. That's the X-Air series. And it is only 16 inputs, this one. This is the XR18. And it only has 16 inputs. It's never going to have more than that. It has a total of 8 outputs, and it's never going to have more than that. You can't add a stage box or anything, and there's no controls on it whatsoever. So you've got to have some kind of control surface for that. The price range on these is reasonably wide. It's roughly $3,000 to $4,000 on the high end, which is number 2. And somewhere around $500 or so for the low end, which is number 7, and the rest are in between that. So the other definition of mixing on glass is using a desktop or touchscreen computer, which is too large to be handheld, to control all the operational parameters of a digital mixing console, which might have no other user interface. If you had another user interface, I don't think you would use this whole thing, but I don't know. These computers are connected to the mixer and power by the necessary cables, meaning that you've got this on the end of a snake. And here's some pictures of that kind of system. This is Elton John's monitor rig with his monitor engineer, Alan Richardson. And the mixing console is the SAC system from RML Labs. This is a picture and from an article in FOH magazine, which is really great. And I can't tell which of those racks has the console part in it, but that's clearly a computer touchscreen on top there, and it looks like there's some physical faders under his hand there, and that's as much as I know about that one. These next couple pictures were sent to me from Mal Brown. Did he show up today? I hope so. I hope I get this right. This is Mal's Dell computer and iPad sitting on a table with a DMX controller next to it that may or may not be sound. And he uses the Soundcraft series, whose names I can't remember, but he can share that with us later if he wants. And here's a closer up picture of the computer screen. That's a touch top or a touch screen computer and a keyboard and mouse, of course. And it looks like you can see a lot of faders, and there's some EQs or EQ and compressor gates and other mix sliders up on the top there. It looks really nice. I used to have Soundcraft stuff and I really liked it. Now I got this one from James Paul with no context whatsoever. And I'm pretty sure that's not James. It looks like there's two touchscreen computers up on top there with three banks of eight faders each under hands down below. And there's some push buttons in the middle there on the side. And maybe those are VU meters, those lit up horizontal stripes. I don't know. But that's in a really nice wooden case. It's pretty much the same form factor as an old analog mixer, but it's definitely not an old analog mixer. So what we're going to concentrate on today is this wireless cordless tablet definition, and that's what I'm going to start talking about. So there's some general principles that I want to convey, and this is also going to be kind of an overview of what we're going to be talking about. So first, what to look for when buying a digital mixer or tablet, what to do to make them work together at the gig, what to do to keep them working together at the gig, what other gear you need to accomplish the above, and then finally, mixing on a tablet at a sound check and show, and we're going to do a simulated situation like that for you. Okay, so first, what to look for. The tablet should be able to control all of the parameters of the console. And now you have to look at me for a minute here because I'm going to tell a story. Some of these consoles that have come out are kind of hybrids. They're some analog and some digital. The important part about digital to me is that there's full recallability for every parameter. And as you shift from scene to scene, you can take groups of inputs from over here and the inputs will be set up properly for that. The next scene, you can take your inputs from over here and the inputs and all of the parameters will be appropriate for that, etc. So as you jump from scene to scene, the entire console moves around to be what it should be. I've seen digital consoles that have input trims that are analog. There's a knob there and everything after that maybe is digital, but that one thing is not. So you have to physically adjust the input trims with every scene. And I think that's a complete fail. I don't understand why that has any use whatsoever. Certainly does not in my world, and maybe it does in yours. So there's my opinion. So going back to the next thing here, whether or not you can control that stuff is a function of the app and not the tablet. Although the app has to support your specific tablet and your tablet has to be capable of running the app. The ability of the console to have an app that lets the user control the console comes from the manufacturer. Usually the app comes from the console maker, but depending on some factors that we won't go into now, but they're basically how open it is. The manufacturer is to other people knowing what's going on in the guts of its unit, it's possible to have third-party apps, and I've heard of a couple of those. So this here is a movie that, the first movie we're going to see here, and this is the Midas M32 app, and the Behringer app is basically exactly the same as this, except the color scheme is a little different, and I kind of like this color scheme better. So here we go. So this is what the M32 app on the iPad looks like. You can see up on top here, these are inputs 1 through 8, 9 through 16, etc., up to 32. Then there's some aux inputs here, sure, tipping sleeve in and out, effects returns, bus outs 1 through 8, 9 through 16, matrix and master out, and then DCAs over here, which are like VCAs. You can see here that this little symbol is the Wi-Fi symbol and indicates that we've got a good connection when it's green. If this is red, that means you got a problem. It means we're connected to the router and the console as well. If you want to look at any given channel, this is the first tab in the individual channel detail section, configuration and preamp. And in here, you can pick the source. So in all the other channels, to get all of these to light up here, they are all set to input 8 so that this channel is going to all of these things that are lighting up in one way or another. You can link channels together here to make a stereo channel. Pushing this button would link number 8 to number 7. It's always an odd and an even, with the odd being left and even being right. When you do that, it switches the pan pots so that 7 is left and 8 is right. If you unlink it, those pan pots stay panned, so you need to manually go and change them back. So be aware of that. Change the polarity of the input. You set the input trim here. So this is an important place. This is where you do the phantom power. You can do a delay on each of the inputs, nothing or half, almost nothing to 500 milliseconds. And you do a low cut in or out on this. You can do inserts, which is more complex than I want to get into. This is whether it's stereo is activated or not. When I did this everywhere, these are the effects returns right here, which we'll get to in a minute. And I neglected to undo that. So the first go around with this explanation was unintelligible because there was so much effects on everything. You can also go to the mono channel, which is often used for subs, activate or deactivate it. The DCA sends are here. You can activate any of these to go to one or more DCAs. And you can also set up mute groups here. There's an auto mix feature, which is only on the first 8 channels, uses Dan Dugan's algorithm. And it's pretty cool, although unfortunately Dan doesn't get any money from this, and I wish he did. So we go to the next tab, and it's gate, and you can have it be active or not active. It's not active right now. There it's active, but we don't need a gate on my voice. There's also a dynamics, which is actually compressor or expander, and you can choose between those. And I've got that active because I want it to do just a little bit of gain reduction when I emphasize something a little too much. And I've got it 2:1 because I like that, and I like these settings over here, the attack and hold and release. Those are fine. I think these are the stock settings. This is what comes up every time you go to a compressor. It's also got a 4-band parametric EQ, and I have a sibilance up here that I take out of myself, and I don't really have any low end happening. We'll go over to sends. This is one way to do for monitors. 1 through 12 are easily available. 13 through 16 are reserved in this configuration for effects sends, but you can change that around, and you can change all of these from post fader to post EQ, pre fader, pre EQ, whatever. Then you can go through and name things, and I chose this color for my color here, and this is the wireless headset, and these letters don't get any bigger, so you've got to wear your glasses sometime if you're old like me. The last one is presets. Okay, the other thing I wanted to show here is that another way to do monitor mixing is to use this sends on fader button, and then you can select any of the 16 mixes here and adjust all of these for mix 4, or all of those for mix 1, or whatever mix you choose to go to here. And that's real handy. That's a real quick way to do monitors. Now let's look at this row on the top here. Yeah, so this is the detail that gets you to all of these tabs for the selected channel. Next we have the effects button. And I'm just going to scroll through them. You can choose from, there's 8 effect slots. And there's probably 50 different effects you can put into the first four and probably 30 or 40 into the second four. And I'm just scrolling through to show you these last four are set up to be graphics for people who like that kind of thing. So this one is reading bus one and two, which is my headset, or actually this output for the camera. This is bus three and four, which is monitors, usually five and six, same, and eight is left and right. Scenes, there's only one scene loaded into this console, and that's this one for this event. And to change scenes, the scene that you're changing to appears here, and you just drag it, and then it appears over here to show that that's the current one. And because this was what was already in there, nothing really changed, I believe. Also in this section, though, you can set up parameters to be safe for when you change scenes. So you can set up on the input channels the preamp, the config page, the EQ, gate and compressor, insert, etc., etc. So you can do a lot of things to save settings from one scene to another, and it can either be parameters or it can be channels. So you can light up any of these to keep those constant across scenes, which is a cool feature and helpful. There's also a meters page, and I set up some compressors and some gates to make this more colorful. The thing has a built-in two-channel USB stick recording setup, and you can choose where you want it to come from, what you play back. If I had a USB stick in there, that the first song that's available would be here, and you can scroll through with that. And you can also record onto this, and there's also an SD recorder, the SD card that you have to set up to be able to record. It's set up now to be 32 in and 32 out. You record all of those things. And I'm showing you this to show the completeness of console depiction on the iPad that is necessary as far as I'm concerned. So here on the routing page, you can select any group of eight inputs you want on this for these different channels, where the aux inputs come from. You can select how the outputs are pat. In this case, output one is mix bus one and two, seven and eight are left and right, etc. And you can also do delays here for any of these outputs. Like if I wanted to delay the left output, I would just do that, and then I can dial it in up to 500 milliseconds. And it's pretty handy. Then the monitor. Or you can put delay, monitor outputs, the level, you can mute it, and you can set up some solo options. You can set up talkback, where you want the talkback microphone to go, whether it's an external mic or whatever. And there's two different talkback configurations you can do. There's also an oscillator in here that has sine wave, pink noise, white noise. You can route it to wherever you want it to go. Then the last one is the setup page, and this first tab is for the iPad, and I wanted to show you how you can turn the mini meters. These are all the mini meters. You turn those on or off. And although it's nice to see those, that there is some bandwidth taken up with those, and I have wondered how much, if in a marginal connection situation, that is a problem. And there's some other things. There's some global settings for different things, which I'm not going to get into. Configuration, remote, if you're controlling via MIDI or whatever. Some preamp adjustments for blocks of eight. What's going, your setup for the X32 card, and then some assignables. On some consoles, the full-size consoles, there's a couple of encoders, and this one has eight buttons that you can assign to be different things. So that is the iPad interface, and pretty much everything that is on the console is in this iPad, and that's handy because there's some consoles that have no physical controls for all intents and purposes, and it's nice to be able to adjust those. All right. So this is a question and answer time. If anybody has any questions that you want to speak up, feel free.
Well done.
Thank you. That wasn't a question. Okay. Anybody want to say anything?
Who makes that program?
That's a Behringer Midas program, which is useful only on their consoles. So any of those first six consoles can be controlled by what you saw there.
Okie doke.
And every manufacturer nowadays of a digital console will have some kind of program like that to let you control their gear. Some of them are not as complete as that, I've heard. Some of them have some other features that aren't part of this one. Did Mal show up? Are you there to talk about your rig, Mal Brown? No, okay. Any other questions? Do you want to stretch or anything before we move on? We got another 20 minutes here before the long break.
I don't know if you're going to address this later, but do you have anything in particular that you use to manage battery life on a remote device? Like if you're going through a tech rehearsal, what do you do to make sure that it survives the entire process?
That's a good question. And I was going to tangentially answer it later, but I think this is a fine time to answer it now. You're right, there is a finite battery life for the tablets. Having the screen full bright diminishes your life considerably. I found maybe a doubling of life by getting it down. If you're in a fairly dark area, in system preferences, at least in the iPad, you can adjust the brightness. There's a slider there, display brightness. And you can double or even triple the life of it by taking it down from full brightness and having it be fairly low, just so that you can see it as a glow. You do want to take your charger with you. You do want to have some spare stuff with you that I'll talk about in a minute. And there are those USB battery packs that work great on these. You can put it in your pocket, like I've got this wireless mic pack, and run a USB cable out your shirt and plug the thing in and work on it while it's charging there. So that's as much as I do, pretty much.
Can you comment on the size of the tablet and how the software might reconfigure itself for like a mini iPad or a larger, or if you're going to carry around a 32-inch TV under your arm? You know, the tablets come in so many different sizes. Can you comment on how the software works there?
I can only comment up to a certain point. And after that, you'll have to do further research. For the iPad mini and the normal size iPad, you just have the bigger screen. It fills the bigger screen. My understanding with the, particularly the computers, so the big, a big screen, the touchscreen guys, that software, at least for a while, only got so big. It wouldn't fill the whole screen, unfortunately, which seemed to me to be a real disadvantage. We saw on Mal's picture that his was filling his whole screen. That was a pretty big screen. I think that was a 21 or 22 or something. So different manufacturers will do different things. The Behringer has changed a little bit over the years. The tablets I use are probably is it 10 inch? The iPad Pro 10.7 or something diagonal. And that's big enough for my eyes. For my old eyes. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, I think what I heard was you're going to have to try it out.
That's basically it, yes. I'm sorry, I don't know every tablet or every system. And every manufacturer is going to have a little different take on what they put in it and how they answer your exact question, I think.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Anything else before we move on? All right, thanks. So next, the console should be able to support multiple tablets. Now, why is that important? And I'll put it back on me here. As I mentioned earlier, I like to be able to see and control multiple layers at once. So one tablet, at least in this system, shows 8 faders at any given moment, 8 channels. And wherever on the console it is, there's 8 things that you can see. If you have multiple, if you have 2 tablets, you can see 16 things at a time. If you have 3, you can see 24. And if you could conceivably, the Behringer consoles will support 12 tablets. So you could conceivably have 96 channels visible, which is more than the whole console has, or pretty close to more. And then you get into a problem of tablet management and where they are. How do you address 12 tablets? But where that comes in handy is if you have a band of trusted musicians who you work with all the time, who you trust not to get into your part of the console, but to stay in their part, because they can adjust their monitor sends and some other features on either a tablet or a phone, even if the manufacturer has a phone app, as the Behringer does. So that's real handy, because then you're they're doing their own mixes and you're not. So as a sound operator, how do you physically manage multiple iPads? And this is a thing that I built for 3 of them. That's some stuff I had around rack rail and some plexiglass type stuff, Tufac, and some screws and a speaker stand adapter. And it's sitting on a speaker stand now, which is real handy for when I am doing a gig with behind a tall bunch of seats. I can raise that as high as I need to and it'll work. Sitting on top of the rack on the left there is the table stand version of that, and here it is sitting on the table stand, so that I've got 24 channels visible there. On the back of that, there's a four banger charger, four USB outputs with captive cords to charge things in case that occurs. And all I have to do is run that AC to a nearby power outlet, and those guys will charge. So here's what they look like in the dark. And what I've done is got color-coded banks of 8, and our national flag is red, white, and blue, so I can remember that order pretty easily. And I do red, white, blue, and green. And blue didn't show up very well in the picture, so I've got channels 1 through 8 on red, 9 through 16 are predominantly white. And then we jump over to 25 through 32 is green. And magenta is effects returns. And I forget what color left and right and matrix are, but color coding stuff lets you keep track, because each of these iPads can be any part of the console. And it gets confusing if you've got your outputs on the left and the inputs on the right, but you need a way to keep things straight. So one thing that concerns me about doing mixes with multiple iPads is when you are doing a mix on a normal console that weighs 100 or 200 pounds or something, when you have to leave the mix position and go somewhere, you can be reasonably assuming that it's going to be there when you come back. But I'm not so sure about iPads. Those are easy to shove under your coat or something and walk. So I had my wife, Kathy, who's you'll meet later here, made these covers for me out of a fairly heavy fabric that I've got. And we used these big Velcro seal strips on the bottom there. So this is a bag basically that goes over what you saw, the iPads. And when you seal it up, any cords that you've got running under there can still get through. And this Velcro makes a huge noise when you go to tear it apart. So it probably wouldn't work too well to do a quiet gig and have to leave and then come back and make a big noise. The other possibility that I've thought of is having a shoulder bag or something that's big enough to hold however many iPads you've got, and just grab them all and stick them in the bag when you've got to go up to the stage or whatever. So back to how to figure these things out. How important to you is it to have delays on the outputs? that seems to be a price point thing. The cheaper consoles don't have that. The more expensive ones, meaning everyone other than the XR series, has both delays on outputs and on every input. So how will you get help when you can't figure something out? There's online forums you can go to. If you have friends who have the same thing, that's a great thing because misery loves company and people like to help you figure stuff out. Can you try this stuff before you buy it? Well, not really anymore, but the reviews and online and people's reports of them in the online forums are really good indicators. Finally, on this little section, can you afford to buy two of them? And why would you want to do that? I'll tell you why, and I want to explore this concept a little bit. First, what level of gig are you doing? Are you doing free gigs because you love doing sound? People like having you come to do that for them, but they're not able to pay you. Well, if something breaks, if you've got one thing and it breaks, the show is over maybe if you can't figure out a solution. And that's the way it is. They're not paying you, so what's the deal? And there's nothing wrong with that. However, if you're doing paid gigs that you want to keep doing, where there's a lot of people and money relying on you doing what you're there to do, you got to keep in mind that you're in show business and the people you're working with are in show business too in some fashion. And show business has a motto: the show must go on. And you remember in Galaxy Quest where Alan Rickman is playing a character who's got a line that he absolutely has to say every time anybody sees him, and everybody loves seeing him, and he's at a Comic-Con with these other guys and he hates doing this line. He's so over it by then. And he says, no, I won't go out. And he refuses to go out on the stage for a while until finally somebody says to him, the show must go on. And he's a trained actor. He's got that in his blood. And he goes out and he does his thing through gritted teeth. You've got to be ready to make the show go on too. And you guys already know that too, but I'm telling you anyway. The thing to remember is that all of this gear is going to turn into junk eventually. It's all going to break at some time. It doesn't matter if it's cheap stuff or it's the most expensive stuff. It's going to turn into junk. So you need to plan for when it breaks and not if it breaks. I went to used to go to the Final Cut Pro user group to learn how to edit Final Cut Pro. And the leader of that, Ed McNichol, told us that if you have one, you have none. So if you've got a movie or a recording of something that is wonderful and you have only one and you don't have a copy, when it gets, that file gets corrupted or lost or whatever, it's gone. So you've got nothing. So if you have two, then you've got one, because if one goes bad, you've got a spare. If you have three, you've got one that you use, and if it goes bad, you've still got one to use and you've got a spare. The other part about having two is that it lets you confirm proper functioning of the one. So if you have a problem with one of them, you can check the exact same conditions on the other one. And if one works and one doesn't, then you've got a problem with the one and you can get it fixed. If it's the same on both, then that's how it's supposed to work. The problem is the nut behind the wheel. You don't know how to use your gizmo, but that helps confirm that you don't know how to use it. So the question really is, can you afford to only have one at the gig? And you've got to answer that for yourself. Now, contrarily, in my role today as the Vidiot providing the video gear, I've got one of some very critical components in the system. And if any of those goes bad, we're going to hang up here, or at least I will have to hang up. So we can hope together that that doesn't happen. So what to do to make them work together at the gig? And remember from examples that I told you and other examples that you know about, if they don't work together, you've got a big problem. So first we're going to talk about the Wi-Fi network and we're going to really dig into it. And I'm sorry it's so boring, but you're an IT person if you're using these tablets, and you need to know some stuff about Wi-Fi and these other many things.
Hey, Dan, this is Bill.
Yes, Bill.
Just before you get into that, because I know this is good stuff coming up here.
Let me go back.
Matt Castle wanted to mention that magnets sewn into the fabric on your iPad or your iPad covers would be quiet.
That's great. Thank you, Matt.
Especially some of those, like the Warrior magnets are super, super strong.
Yes, that's a great idea. Thank you.
and then Hano.
Yes.
Says, I hear that the Apple app doesn't work with the new iPad OS. If it hasn't been updated, is that true?
I pointedly do not update my iPads. It works now. I don't care. you need. There's some security things you need to do. I have not uploaded the latest iOS for that exact reason. I think people have reported, with not only these programs but other things too, that Apple, in its quest to make things perfect, makes them also unusable and discontinues stuff that really does work, as we'll see in a minute. Does anybody else have any information about that?
Lawrence is saying a couple of things. Lawrence, do you want to chime in here?
I was just being a doofus. I was saying that you want it to make a lot of noise when you rip open the cover, so when somebody's stealing your iPad, you hear it and you come running. So
I think I need two covers, one for the classical gigs and one for the rock gigs.
What a snap.
I think that is a great idea, the magnets, though. Anything else?
That's all that's on the list.
Alrighty, thank you. Thank you, guys. So for your Wi-Fi network, you want to, and this is true for wired networks between the console and the stage box as well. You want to have dedicated networks. You don't want to connect it to the internet. You've got no use. Your console has no use for the internet by and large. I don't know about other manufacturers, but these don't. And you don't want to connect to a campus-wide trunk system. And I'm going to break in here and tell you a story about a guy that I know who works on a big university campus, not too far from where I'm sitting. And he's the sound guy there, or one of them. And they have, in his case, he's told me that they have a mandatory connection to the common network. Their IT people refuse to have any private networks on the campus. And this is a couple years ago. I haven't seen him for a little while. So their Yamaha console connected to their stage box had intermittent problems. It wouldn't connect. Things were just not happening. They had some big problems with it and did some big research to try to find what was going on. And they eventually found that a printer in a building, a couple of buildings away, had the exact same IP address as the console, which, when they weren't being used simultaneously, was maybe fine, but because they worked on different hours maybe, but when they were together, it was a big trouble. So they changed the IP address and it was fine, but there's no reason that you need to be connected to the trunk. I mean, for crying out loud. So now I need to go to that. The next piece is the router, which is the interface between the console and the tablet. And as I've kind of hinted so far here, most of my experience is with the Airport Express, which this is the thing I was referring to. Apple, in its infinite wisdom, has decided to discontinue this product and I think all other base station products. So you can't get them anymore. And you can't really see it from the picture, I think, but it's like 4 inches square with an inch and a quarter or so thickness. And it's a real rugged plastic. It's not real flimsy. My Linksys ones are real flimsy. This is a refurb, I'm sorry to say, and it's that much money. The refurbs that I bought directly from Apple were about a third of this, but you can't get them anymore. But this is what I'm gonna be talking about here today because that's my experience. So the principles for setting it up. The system security for your network is all in your router. Yes, there's a password protection on your tablet and you can lock your console maybe, but the console can be defeated by restarting the console. So you wanna have some pretty good passwords and security protocols. And there's three possible types of protocols for routers. One is WEP, which is the oldest, but it's not secure anymore. And I'm going to show you a Behringer device that came out with a built-in router, but it only uses WEP protocol, so you don't want to use that one. WPA is newer and better than WEP, but it's still not as good as WPA2, and that's the one you want to use. And don't ask me what the difference is between those. There are people who know, and all I know is that WPA2 is the super duper one. So with any router, you're going to want to have two bitchin passwords. And I don't mean you use the word bitchin in your password, but you want to have real robust, strong passwords. One of them is the administrator password for the router, which lets you get into it and change passwords or change its functioning or whatever. You don't want to ever give that one out. You're the only one who has that password. Then there's a user password that allows you to use that router. And you still don't want to give that one out. You don't post it on the router with a Sharpie or something. You keep that pretty close to your chest because anybody who has that password can then control your console with the proper software. So I'm going to leave it up so that we can remember that. The routers operate on either 2.4 gigs or 5 gigahertz or both. There's a debate about which of those you should use. 2.4 goes farther, but that spectrum is really crowded. There's only 13 choices within that 2.4 gig range, but all but three of them overlap with something else. So the only really usable channels are 1, 6, and 11 to not be subject to interference by other channels. The 5 gig doesn't go as far, but there's a lot more space up there. The most networks I've ever seen at a gig were somewhere over 144 visible ones, and I'll show you how to see them in a minute here. My tablet system worked just fine with all those networks around it. The last show that I did in February, there was 17 that were visible that were stronger than any of mine. And the digital stuff seems to really be able to talk. Once it locks into the sender, locks into the receiver, it seems to really be able to ignore all the other stuff. It's been surprising how well that works. And I'll show you in a minute how you see the networks. The next thing you need to decide is a hidden network name versus a visible network name. And we'll look at how you do the scanning right now. So if you have an iPhone or an iPad, you have in it an airport utility app. If you go to the iPhone or iPad system preferences and open the airport utility app, you see this screen, and this is the bottom of this first screen that you see in the airport utility. And I've scrolled down to save us some time, although the explanation probably took longer than doing it would take. And at the bottom there, you see this label Wi-Fi scanner. And there's a slider there. And when it's green, you can use the Wi-Fi scanner. Default is off, of course. So if you want to scan using your iPhone or iPad, just flip that over there to the right there. If you don't have Apple products, there's a program called Fing that works on other programs, other platforms, and there probably are other ones too, but F-I-N-G works for sure. So now we're going to go to the first screen in the Apple utility, which is this one here, and it shows you how the devices that it sees and if they are connected to the internet or not. The green little green dot says that they are. Now the Wi-Fi scan in blue in the upper right hand corner, that's a button. So if you press that button, you get this screen, which wants you to tell it how long you want the duration of your scan should be. In continuous, it'll go for however long you want. I usually want it to go for 45 seconds, so I slide it over there. And then when you press the button in the upper right-hand corner again, which is now labeled scan, you get a screen like this that starts with the strongest network at the top, and you can scroll down to see the other active networks. And let's look at each entry here. So starting from the top there, we see AirMort. So that first word, first name, is the name of the network as set by the user. These are both visible networks that we're looking at here. The string of numbers and letters that's right below that identifies that model and maybe even that individual of router, that has a manufacturing database somewhere where you can find what router, kind of router that is. The next thing down, RSSI, is received signal strength indicator, and that measures how strong the signal is in dBm, which is apparently the one they use for radio transmissions. And in this case, it's a negative number as compared to zero, which is full scale. So the higher, the smaller the negative number, the stronger the signal. So in this case, this one is minus 50, the one below it is minus 70. So the 50 is 20 dBm stronger than the other one. The last thing in that entry is where it says channel 149. The three-digit numbers, and maybe even two-digit, I'm not sure about that, are the 5 gig channels. And the single digits up to 13 are the 2.4 gig. So that's how you tell what it is. And the Airport Express is broadcast simultaneously on both 2.4 and 5 gig. But the iPads, I've not been able to figure out a way to tell which one I'm connected to. I use the same name on both of them. You have to name both your 2.4 and your 5 gig. And I use the same name for both of them because I figure that it's going to switch automatically to it, and that's all I need. Maybe if I change the name, I would know better. So moving on. Now we see a couple that have hidden names. You don't know if they are what they are or where they are. So I'm going to make you look at me again here. Even though these networks don't have names, they are still crackable if the wrong security or wrong passwords are used. So you need to be careful again to have a strong password. And these, you always imagine that there's some kid who's bored who's going to be trying to crack your network for fun. And I've never heard of it. I've never heard of somebody seizing control of something, but that doesn't mean it can't happen. So then here's the last two in that series, and you can see that we're down in the minus 90s. So the top network was minus 50, and the bottom network in this case is minus 94. I've never seen one that's above minus 30 or 40, I think. So I don't know what the deal is there. Okay, so the next thing you need to decide is if you're using DHCP or a static IP. DHCP, let me see here. Nope, I'm too ahead of it there. DHCP is more or less automatic if it's set up right. Some part of the system sends out an IP address to things that want to attach to it so that the IP addresses all work together. Some people feel that static IP is more reliable. When I started doing this, we couldn't get DHCP to work on the early consoles, so all of mine are static. And now, before we move on detail of how to set IP, do we have any questions or comments?
Nobody's on the list.
Okay. And I think that this is our intermission, if that works for you guys.
So, again, so far so good, Dan.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you're doing great, man.
So yes, having an intermission, or you want to power through?
I think we're good for powering through here at least, unless someone needs to go get some, because people can go and turn off their video and go do what they need to do and come back anyway. So they aren't
really limited. That's a good point. Okay. I'm happy to power through. However, I'm going to go for another 20 minutes without coming up for air. So if you want to interrupt me at any time, feel free. That would be fine with me.
Dan, just one thing.
Yes.
I know the Airport Express is starting to become a problem now because you can't get it. We've been using Ubiquiti stuff.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that.
You've been using the simple Edge router and the little circular disk Infinity units. A little bit of a nightmare to set up, but once they're set up, we find them incredibly reliable and really, really good.
Good.
Especially the later ones that you can mesh the disks.
Yes.
And what we have now is we tend to have one disk up at the back of the room or away. We are outdoors a lot, so we have it up, you know, somewhere hiding, you know, up on top of a big mic stand or something like that.
Yes.
And the other one lurking on the stage. And honestly, I have never really had any dropouts or anything since.
Awesome.
Just good alternatives. And not that expensive, especially if Airport Expresses look as though they're going to become a commodity on Amazon.
I hope so. I got a bunch of them. So.
Hey, Dan, that makes me think of a question, which is
good.
A lot of the data that you're dealing with here, it's probably relatively low bandwidth, isn't it? Because it's not audio data; it's just control data from the controller to these logic boards on the actual hardware, right? So,
yeah.
is it a low load situation, and that's why as long as you have a reliable connection, that's all you really need? Is that what's going on here?
I can't answer that except to say. Go ahead.
It is. We use, lately we've been using an Alan Heath D-Live, mm-hmm. and I had an outdoor orchestra gig, and eventually I had over 18 radio, you know, Wi-Fi controllers running, doing monitors, side stage, and mm-hmm. all, and, you know, individual iPads all over the place, and the thing didn't even blink. There was no obvious slowing down of anything. So, yeah, and that's, the D-Live is quite, you know, it's quite a lot of data running. There was like 80 odd channels worth of meters running on some of these things, and it never as much as blinked.
Cool. Do you have a Y-Pry or anything similar to that, which looks at 2.4 gig frequencies and gives you a visual display, a waterfall display? Waterfall? What's the other one where it's colors depending on the intensity?
I'll use an Android phone, which has got, I've got an app on my Android phone, and it can literally do all that sort of thing. And I'll run that, or I've got a little radio scanner that if we've got a little radio mics around, we're using that anyway, and that will run up to 2 and 5 gig. We tend to use 5 gig here, because mm-hmm. especially now we've got the meshes running.
Yes.
We don't have to use the 2.5 for the
You're
range.
You're not projecting as far.
Yeah, and I have to say, even without the mesh, it still works very, very well. As long as there's no sandstone walls in the building or something, it's pretty good.
Does your Wi-Fi analyzing gizmo look at the traffic on the bands and tell you how much traffic there is on each Wi-Fi band? Because that's what Wi-Pry does.
Yeah, I know Wi-Pry does that. I've never found the need for that, to be honest, Dan.
I have it, and I've never found it useful. It's interesting.
Yeah, as long as there's not millions of channels blocking up, as you say, on the 2.5 gig, it definitely, if you get a whole pile of overlappers, then it makes sense to maybe go onto the router and shove it onto a different channel that doesn't do it by itself.
Yeah.
But over in this country, on 5 gig, it's pretty empty.
Yeah,
the only people that tend to use it are TV people, actually. They're in use sometimes, but other than that, it's not a big deal.
When I've looked, it's generally relatively empty on 5 gig here, too. I mean, there's so many different bands in 5 gig, though, that you can choose from. In 2.4, it's like this, but in 5 gig, it seems like it's like that more. But there
I would
go.
Say that you should change the names on your 2.5 gig channel and your 5 gig channel. Just sometimes it's handy to be able to switch it, you know, if something is blocking you.
How do you switch it? How do you
just give it a different name, and it'll come up with the two channel names, and you can tell it to forget which ones.
Right,
just tell it to forget which one's giving you trouble. That's kind of how you do that.
But then you have to enter your password to do that, right? Or does it? I guess it automatically, if you do auto join, it jumps right to it.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can just tell if it's auto joining and being a nuisance, you just tell it to forget it.
Right.
And it'll stay on the one that's working for you.
Great.
Hey, Dan.
Yes.
the thing about the control, and you know, there's no audio, but can you monitor or solo monitor a channel in your headphones that are connected up to your iPad?
No.
Stereo.
No, that's strictly data that's going to and from the iPad. If you want to solo anything, you've got to put a wireless headset or a very long wire, I guess.
Well, can you control that from your pad?
Control the solo?
Control what you're hearing in your wireless?
Yeah,
Okay.
Yeah, you can solo. You can PFL anything you want to or solo it.
Excellent.
But you've got to have that extra transmitter.
Yeah, and that's easy.
I've never found that to be necessary, quite honestly. And maybe Gordon differs, but when I'm doing a gig on an iPad, most of the time I'm just doing monitors or something. I try to do most of the gigs, although that isn't true either.
Well, I'm thinking you might need to troubleshoot a bad a channel or something, hum or buzz or something.
You can see every channel has an LED ladder on it, and you can see buzz or hums anyway that sit there and quiver. I generally don't solo anymore, even on consoles. I rarely solo, and that's a failing, I'm sure. But
Dan, I got a question to follow up on that. So you're just to get flow, because I haven't done this, and maybe other people here haven't either. So the idea is that you've got your iPad, and you've got your perch somewhere in front of house, but you can wander. I mean, I know we've seen our lab manager, Dustin, when we do our things in our auditorium at the school, mm-hmm. you know, he can wander. And what you're saying is, do I understand it, is that because you can control and you are in control of the entire live mix, you're basically just listening to the room. Is that, I mean, you're listening to what's coming out of the speakers. You're not monitoring something on headphones. Is that what you're saying?
In my case, that's true.
For you, yeah. And I don't mean it's
mostly
the
true. Okay. When I find the iPad incredibly useful when I'm doing a sound check, because I can stand up with the musicians, and this is as good a time as any to talk about that, rather than having to shout to the back of the room or use a talkback or whatever. I can stand there and I can listen to their monitors and hear what it is that they're doing. And if they want something, I can talk in this tone of voice and say, how about this? And they say, well, I need a little bit of that. And I can go in and do that and say, how about that? And it goes really fast to do monitors that way. And it's really civilized way to do them. I do shows where I'm entirely mixing on the iPad out front. And I don't solo during the show.
Would you have a occasion to look at the spectrum of one of the channels?
Yeah, there's the relatively recent software, although I guess it's a few generations ago, the firmware for the app lets you see that on the iPad. You can see the third octave spectrum, or you can even do, I think, the RTA does a waveform rather than just bars.
That's a little bit better in some cases than just, I mean, if you.
Oh, it's great. It's great.
It wasn't enough.
If there's feedback happening, you see it and you go vomp, and you just deal with it real quickly.
Very
cool. Right exactly where it is. That does take up a little more bandwidth too, but as Gordon says, it's pretty low bandwidth to start, so I've not had a problem. Yes.
I just put in a link to an article on 6 gigahertz Wi-Fi that's
really
coming out new, and it's going to make a much wider spectrum availability.
Yeah, they want to take the ham bands away for that.
Is that right?
Yeah. So take a look at that. This is the world now.
And while we're talking to Gordon, he mentioned the Ubiquiti routers. There's another, I think it's a Ubiquiti, that's like a tube, and it's waterproof, so you can put it out in the rain or something.
Yeah, that thing you got to be careful with, though. If you start using that at its full capability, it can actually wipe out people's Wi-Fi for quite some considerable distance round about. We have a couple of those, and they'll quite happily run a full well, an American football field. They'll happily run the full length of that. Wow. The problem with that is that your transmission from your iPad isn't big enough to reach back. That's where you start to run into limitations with that, hence the reason why you're better to mesh them out.
Interesting.
The limitation when you start using these guys is not what they're transmitting from the router, it's what you're transmitting back to it.
Right.
That's the thing that usually stops you.
Right.
May I interject that on the Ubiquities, you can adjust the output, the transmission levels, and throttle them back to handle that very situation.
Yeah, but when you don't know the thing very well and you just whack it on, yeah, you ended up with a rather irate IT person in a college coming and chasing us around the building.
Awesome. Dan, I've converted my lab over to Ubiquity.
Yeah? All right. Hey, Dan. Yeah, go ahead.
So I just wanted to clarify, are you saying that when you do your live gigs that you're not using headphones really at all as a part of the process? Even when you're checking lines, are you using headphones?
Is this meeting being recorded?
Yes. Yes, that is correct. When I do my line check, I suss out problems then. And that's the other great thing about doing iPad mixing is that you don't need somebody at the house and somebody on stage tapping the mic. You can do it yourself. You mm-hmm. sit there with the iPad and you do this and you go, check, that works. And then you move on to the next one and you do that, and you're not coordinating which one you're working on. You know it's this one right here, and you check it, and you so I test it then, and you're supposed to. I read that. Yeah,
well, I think it's interesting because I work with digital mixers, and I'm still kind of stuck in those old ways where when I'm doing line check, I PFL everything.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, Greg. It's fine.
I guess I just bring it up because I really appreciated Bob's question, because it strikes me as an kind of an interesting paradigm shift with this different digital mixing.
For me, it is a huge paradigm shift to be able to test every channel by myself while I'm standing next to it, not having to be out there somewhere, but here I am and here's the microphone and I can touch it and make a noise and I can bring the volume up and I can change everything about it right there. And if it's not working, I know. If I've mispatched something, I know right then. If you don't have time to go through that before the talent is there, then I agree that's a problem. But if you have time to do it, and I do my best to make time, I'm not soloing. Go ahead.
I find myself just going around as I'm wiring up the stage and just doing it every channel as I plug it in. I'm literally going, right, you alive. Yep.
Yeah, that's next, great.
You know, and just keep walking your way around it.
How do you carry your iPad around? How to keep your hands? How do you carry your iPad around to keep your hands?
Oh, just tossed on the floor or wherever I'm working. And then I usually spend there's at least once every gig I spend 5 minutes looking for the thing because I've laid it down somewhere and I've got a clue where to put it. But using the IEM system, when I'm doing the orchestra gigs and we're setting up and we get something like 200 channels running, then it's great.
Oh, jeez.
You have a couple of guys running around with iPads hooked onto the desk and on a separate PFL, and they can run around and do all the – they can dodge around and find all the dead channels for you while you're setting stuff up.
Awesome.
That's a great idea.
Gordon, we've got to do a meeting with you where you're showing pictures of all of this. This sounds wonderful.
I'll see if I can get some videos and pictures of stuff and show you them later.
Great. Great. Thank you.
Hey, Dan, there was one comment from Lou Coley, and just to get your response on this, about the X32 port being 10 or 100 megabit as opposed to gigabit Ethernet.
Yeah. 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 They don't care about gigabit. It's plenty fast enough. And it's kind of the same way with the CAT cable that you use. They spec CAT5E, which I think is 100 gigabit or 100 some megabits. I can't keep that stuff straight. It's 100 whatever, and then there's 1,000 for CAT6 or 6A. And it works fine at the lower bit rate. It works fine at the higher bit rate. sometimes the routers or the switches are cheaper at the gigabit ones.
Hey, Dan, it's Lou. Yes. I just wanted to chime in. The reason I said that about the port was more to say that the traffic is very low because it only has 100 megabyte overhead, not a gigabit.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, good point. Thanks. Anything else?
It looks like you've successfully had a 15-minute Q&A. Good job.
Yeah, but nobody got a break. So.
Yeah. So hey, I get one question here, Dan.
Sure.
What's the protocol for connecting the stage boxes, the digital snakes, all that? Are you connecting that with Cat 6 too? I mean, I've just done a couple systems and that's what was spec'd, you know, but it's pretty high. 9624.
Certainly some of the newer consoles are requiring that from what I've heard. That's not my world anymore. I'm a pretty low feeder. The Behringer stuff, like I said, it specs Cat 5e, and I've had people argue with me and say, oh no, you can't use Cat 6 or 6a because there's more twists per inch, and that's problematic and all of this, and that's all bullshit. The transport protocol for consoles, or at least for the Behringer ones, is an AES spec. They use AES 50 as their transport protocol. And if you get the standard from the AES, which you can do as a full member, to download all of that stuff for free, that's a plug for being an AES member, and read it, and the devices that are made have to conform to the spec. And it specs Cat 5e as a minimum, and it says Cat 5e or greater capacity. So Cat 5, Cat 6, Cat 6a, Cat 7, Cat 22, whatever they get up to eventually. Anything larger than that should work fine with that.
And Hanno mentioned shielded being a part of the spec too.
Yes, it has to be shielded. It is a major static issue.
Yes, that's true. I'm not sure that it's in the spec, though. And if it is in the spec, it was because of EMF radiation rather than immunity from ESD, electrostatic discharge. And a guy named David Wynn discovered that when you were using the Behringer consoles with unshielded cable and you shuffle your feet on carpeting or something and touch either the console or the stage box or a microphone that's connected to the stage box, when you get a spark like you get from your finger from static, the console would either disrupt the signal in between would disrupt, and either it would make a noise or it would go quiet, and in extreme cases the console would reboot. And he discovered that if you use shielded cable in between the console and the stage box with EtherCon connectors on the end, they look like XLR shells, but they're around a RJ45 connector. EtherCon, shielded cable, connected both ends, is immune to electrostatic discharge. And prior to that, Behringer had not said anything about needing shielding. And they did have some boilerplate in their manual that said, because of European rules about electromagnetic radiation, you need to use shielded cable. But it had nothing to do with any of that. And their other spec said you can use any cable that you can get at the hardware store or dime store, any CAT cable and a CAT 5, and it'll work fine. But that turned out not to be true. Midas still says that you don't need shielded cable with their consoles. And I have proven, this guy David Wynn did it with a barbecue sparker. He modified a barbecue sparker so that the spark could jump to a surface. And that simulated shuffling your feet on the floor and then touching something with your finger. and I got one and changed it too, and I disrupted a Midas console for sure. Not these little guys, but the real ones. And you do want to use shielded cable, that's true.
Well, and then Luke Pacholsky brought up the point that Cat5e will handle gigabit, but that Cat6 may have less delay, which maybe that would explain the system I'm doing is 9624, a fair amount of channels.
Great. Maybe
that's why they spec that. That'd
okay.
A good point.
We're getting into cable. This is a wireless talk, damn it. So let's, if we're done with cable talk, let's get back to the thing here so that we are moving along. Any other questions before we go? All right. Thank you. Really, thanks for that. That was great. Okay, we're going to talk about operation and connectivity. And let me see here. Problems can happen even when things are set up correctly. And at the beginning of my world with the Airport Expresses and the X32s, I had a situation that would happen periodically. The situation that you want to happen is that you connect the router up correctly to the console and you dial into the router with your tablet and you connect then to the console. That's what you want to have happen. What was happening to us was that sometimes I would connect it up and the tablet would not talk to the console. And I'd redo the connections and I'd swap cables and even swap routers and it would not work. And then we left it connected and went on to use just the console. And after some period of random time, and it chose it itself, it would start working and it would stay working again for the rest of the gig. And that was very vexing. And we finally discovered that, I guess I need to go change this here. The solution to that was to put a switch in the middle. Did I already talk about this? No, I don't think so. Okay. And this is the switch that I used. There's others that'll work. This is a little metal one. And these are pretty cheap. And the gigabit switches, I feel like I've talked about the gigabit switches being cheaper than these sometimes. You can use a gigabit switch, but you don't need it for this stuff. So
are you sure that one's a gigabit?
That one was not a gigabit. Oh,
okay.
But at the time that I looked that up, it was cheaper than the gigabit. So I showed you that one.
Probably doesn't look any different.
It doesn't look any different. The letters on it are different. I can tell you that because I've got some gigabit and they work fine too. Okay, so you need to have a line of sight between your wireless router and your tablet. You don't put it on the floor. You don't put the router on the floor where people are going to get in the way. You don't have put it behind a concrete wall or something from where the tablet's going to be. It's got to be out in the world somehow. And I'll tell you a little story. When I started doing these, I was doing an outdoor event, not a huge one, but huge enough, I guess. And I put it, the router, I think on top of the rack, which was about 2 feet up from the ground. And a bunch of people came in and stood, and I was back where I used to be for my mix position with my tablet. And I lost signal. And that was nasty, but the beauty of the tablet is I just walked towards the router until I got signal and then it worked. And then I just stood there the rest of the show. And so there's that. So what can you do to maintain line of sight? And I suggest hanging it from the speaker because speakers need to have the same locational characteristics as the router. Oops, I didn't show you the slide. The speaker needs to be up above people's heads. The speaker needs to be not behind a wall. It needs to be where it can point right at people's ears. And here is a little gig that I do in a coffee shop repeatedly. And I don't have a pointer, I'm afraid, but you can see two speakers on sticks there. And the left one, about 6 inches or 8 inches down from the bottom of the speaker, there's an Airport Express hanging there. And that works great to cover the whole place. So this here is two Airport Expresses, one on top of the other, kind of glued together, sitting on a plexiglass or Tufac L-shaped thing. And there's a Atlas LO2 down below there, so I can stick it on top of a mic stand or a speaker stand if I can't hang it from a speaker. I'm simulating a speaker hang with this. And it looks like crap, quite honestly. But when it's in context with all this other garbage that it has to be in, the, well, it's not garbage, but my stuff that needs to be in a space with, in a big space, because it's probably a big space, nobody even sees this. There's a Cat 5 coming up from below there. And I discovered that with two Airport Expresses, I could jump one to the other. And that seemed to be just as effective with the X32 rack that this is connected to as did a switch. So I got instant connection every single time with this, just the same as with a switch. Switch has instant connection every single time. So you're seeing the jumper up there from the Cat 5 going down. On the right, there's a stereo eighth inch that is outputting AirPlay to the console down below. And AirPlay is a playback streaming thing from a tablet or a phone. It's great for music, but not so great for cues if you have a timing issue that you need to nail. But this works great for playing music at shows. So when you're setting up a router, it's pretty much always located at the console for a variety of reasons, just from simplicity. Although if you have the proper cable, Cat 5 or E or better, it can be located up to 100 meters, which is 328 feet from the console. If the actual console is the primary control device, then that's likely out in the house, so that's where the router is likely to be. If the tablet is primary control, then the console is likely at the stage. And if you want to control from far away and your router doesn't project that far, you can put another one down there. So you can have more than one router connected to a console, and or you can have more than one console connected to a router. They all need to have different names and different IP numbers, different addresses. And it's easiest if only the last digit of the IP address is different. And I'll show you an example of that in a few minutes here. Now, why would you want to have two routers on the same network? One reason is that if you've got a tablet that's mixing monitors down at the stage where the full console is out at front of house, so there's some distance between them, and you're using the same console to do monitors. And I'll jump over here to tell you that I do this July 4th gig every year that it's actually Dave Campbell and I do it. And he sits down at the stage with a tablet and I have the little console out front, and there's most of the afternoon, most of the day is pie eating and dance exhibitions and stuff like that. But there's a few bands that perform. And it's real simple to have him at the stage in using the tablet to control the monitor mix on my console, so we don't have to have two consoles there. And I need to be fairly delicate about adjusting the trim on each channel, but if you've got somebody that you trust on both ends, then it works out okay. And we put an Airport Express down on the stage and connect it up to the snake. My snakes have three Cat cables in them. So one of them is the console to the stage box, and one of them is the Airport Express to the switch up above at the console. And then the third one is a spare. So that's why you might have that. Another reason is that if you have one tablet that you want to control both the monitor and the front of house consoles at different times. You can't control two consoles with one tablet simultaneously. But if you want to be able to connect to the monitor console up on the stage, and you want to also use the same tablet connect to the front of house console, then connecting both consoles to the same router or even to two routers, which is better since you're far away, that works out well. So next we're going to look at setting IP addresses. And because I do static, I'm going to show you how to do static. And DHCP, like I said, is pretty automatic apparently, except I couldn't get it to work that time. So this is an iPad preferences, and the Wi-Fi is highlighted. And we see that on the right side, the Wi-Fi is green, which means that Wi-Fi is on. It's connected to DanSound 56 with a check mark next to it. And the check mark is real important. If there's a little spinny there, it means it's not connected and you've got to do what we're going to do next here. There's no internet connection. It is important to them that it's like that, but I don't care about that. So if we scroll down that same page, we get to the bottom here and it says either forget this network, as Gordon mentioned before, or auto join. And auto join again lets you, once you connect and go through the process that we're going to go through here with a network, auto join lets the tablet connect directly up to the network that you've previously set up this way without even thinking about it. It just goes and does it. The next fields underneath IP4 address are configure IP, and that, and the IP address and the subnet mask down below, those are all statements of what you've done after you've done the next thing that we're going to do, which is to click that little caret to the right of configure IP and jump over to this page, which the top three fields are checkboxes, actually. Automatic checkbox is a says you want to use DHCP. Manual is static and you want to use that if that's checked. Boot P, I don't know what that is and I don't know that I need to know. Once you check manual, these three fields down under manual IP open up and you enter your data into there. And under IP address, I'm using 192.168.20. And the something is the part that's interesting and that you have to change around. The previous part, as I understand it, and someone will correct me if I'm wrong here, but this 192.168.20 indicates that this is some kind of free network or something. It's not one thing, it's something that you can do in this kind of situation. And I don't know if anybody wants to chime in there, but.
It means it's not routable, like it won't go out over the internet.
Great, okay, cool, thank you.
Hey, also Dan, Luke, yes. Mentioned that BootP is an ancient auto-configuration protocol similar to DHCP.
Oh, interesting. Does anybody use it anymore? Is there any reason to use it anymore?
It is used in some cases for like installing an OS onto your computer.
Okay.
Not very common.
Okay, great. Thank you. So when you are setting this IP address, you are setting the IP address of the iPad. You're not setting anything else. You're setting this so that the world will know what the IP address of this iPad is that you're using. And every iPad.
Your local area network IP address. Your LAN.
My understanding is that it is this device's IP address, and that my console has a different IP address and my router has a different IP address.
Yep. And this one is, yeah, the domain or subdomains, that 20, for instance, they all yes. have to be 192.168.20. They all have to be
yes.
either that or abridged.
Yes. And I'm talking about the 26. So those yep. first eight digits have to be the same for every device, but the last two digits or the last however many digits need to be specific to each device and different for each device, right?
Yep, 256 possibilities.
Okay, okay. Then there's the subnet mask thing, and these numbers work for me. I've done things where I just use the first six digits the same, and then the last part is zero, and that doesn't work for me. So 255.255.255.0 seems to work on all of my stuff. The router.
Normally.
Yes, go ahead.
Normally, your IP address would be the same main left numbers as the router. Normally.
That's curious. Because on the route, let me say how to say this. The router itself, yes, you're right, but I'm on the iPad now. And when I leave the router number at 0.0.0.0 4 zeros, that doesn't work. 10.10.10.10 works just fine on any router that I use.
In this situation, the router is probably never actually used because it's only ever used if it's trying to get to an address that doesn't match the subnet mask, to be technical.
Huh.
And you're only ever addressing devices that are in the same subnet. So it never has a reason to try and use that router address.
It's unusual that it would give it a 192.
It is not typical to be a different subnet. But
if it's DHCP...
All bets are off. I don't know anything about that. Okay. So once you get these numbers entered here, in order to save them, you need to hit the caret up above next to DanSound 56. If you jump back to Wi-Fi, don't ask me how I know this, but if you jump back to the Wi-Fi tab without clicking that caret, you have to do this all again. It doesn't take. So we're going to jump back a page, and we see that this summary is what we set up on the other page. And we click the Wi-Fi back thing again, and we come back to that front page, and we are in this. I scrolled down on this. Sorry. I scrolled down to DNS. I don't know what DNS is, but I leave it at automatic, and I don't know what HTTP proxy is, and I leave that alone too. So. If somebody feels something needs to change there, go ahead and tell us. But I'm coming back to this front page here, and the checkbox is there. And again, if anything is wrong over there, if it's set up for automatic and your stuff is static, you'll get a little swirly there next to the check. You won't get the checkbox. So when you come to this page, when you're choosing your router or you're choosing your networks, as soon as you see the checkbox, you don't need to look at any of that other stuff. And just to be clear, you don't need to have Bluetooth on for it to connect here. I just happen to have that on this one.
Yeah, and Lawrence brought up that DNS is domain name server.
Okay.
Just
that's useful to know. Maybe. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, that would be something that you would, if you're connecting to things on the internet, you'd need to look up dansoundinc.com or whatever. But if you're connecting to from your iPad to a mixer that's right. Just going to go by IP address, you wouldn't need DNS.
Right. And again, you can't connect directly from your iPad to the mixer. You've got to go through a router. But yeah, I got your point there.
And I'm getting some more comments here.
Good.
Joe says DNS is used to resolve named devices to IP addresses. I think that might be the other guy just said.
Okay.
And then Mark says, I apologize. Let me see I'm going to just read it. I apologize to Dan for fading away here. It's after midnight.
Oh man. I'm empathetic. Believe me.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
And that's Mark Sibilia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How's Gordon doing? How's Gordon doing?
I'm all right.
Still awake.
All right. All right. Thank you. What an honor this is, man. This is great. Okay. Is that it, Bill?
Just one minor thing, if you get, yeah. So saying about you needed a router in between, I have not dealt with these specifically, but from everything you're saying, it sounds like you need to have a Wi-Fi access point. It doesn't necessarily have to have a router in it, because the router is to get you to the internet. So yes, you could have an access point that didn't have a router in it, and as long as you had everything configured correctly, you'd still be able to connect back and forth to your mixer.
I am absolutely not on the same page of knowing all of that stuff. So I've heard the term access point, and I'm positive you're right that.
Yeah, it's just for consumer networking, 99 times out of 100, Wi-Fi is kind of built in with a router. It's kind of but they can be separate devices.
Yes, yes. Is it possible to get access points that are cheap and reliable?
Yeah, the little Ubiquiti edge routers that we
yes, use, that's what that is.
They can be made to be an access point only.
Okay.
It's a bit of a nightmare to do, apparently, but that's why I've got somebody that's 40 years younger than me that works with this. But once it's done, the thing appears to be deadly reliable, and they're not that expensive.
My advice is to always find a high school kid when you need to do this kind of stuff. When my son was living with us, he was totally into this and saved my ass so many times figuring this stuff out. So
it might be worth noting, I'll probably just reveal my ignorance, but because I was looking into just this week rather in depth, online jamming, which requires, mm-hmm. you know, extremely low latency. We're talking about 30 milliseconds. And I learned
jamming
the difference.
Meaning playing together, not blocking.
Yeah, in other words, actually
signals.
Collaborating at the same time with people
yes.
you know, who aren't there. So, but I learned the difference between UDP and TCP and all that, and I won't bore you with it. But what I did learn, I think, and there are clearly people here who know more about this than me, so please correct me if I had this wrong, but I was happy to learn this, which was the cable modem, the device that's connecting you to the World Wide Web, to the wide area network, or the WAN, that is the device that's transmitting everything behind it out into the broader internet. But everything behind that, which very often also includes a firewall, is the local area network, which is what you're dealing with. So the router's job is to take a single IP address, whether it's dynamic or static, and then to split it up amongst all the devices on your local area network. And that's all that you're doing with all of your stuff here. You're not really worrying about the wide area network, the greater internet. You're only right. dealing with these devices communicating to each other. So when you said that the signal had to go through the router, the packets, I believe if you could get the access point, you would say, to heck with the wide area network. We're just going to just have this local network, and right. the devices still have to communicate to each other, and they do have to each have unique yes. address, an IP address. And I think that, so anyway, for me, that's sort of like, oh, good, now I know that, and it helped me understand some of what you're talking about.
Cool. Thank you.
Bob Gudgel also said turning Bluetooth off helps keep the iPad from bogging down with useless tasks.
Interesting.
Yeah, I like that.
That's good to know. I've noticed that my iPad Pros bog down more than my Air 2.
Just turn off any programs or apps or anything that you're not using that uses CPU and memory.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
And battery.
Yes.
And especially battery.
Yeah. All right. Anything else? This is great, you guys. Thank you. Okay. To the console. This is the screen on a M32R, which is pretty much the same screen as on all the other Behringer products and Midas, this series of Midas, not the big ones. So we're in the home screen now, which is the first one you come to. And I know that because the light in the upper left button that says home is on. Where we want to go is to the setup screen, which is hidden under the thumbnails here, but I'm quite confident that it's lit up on the right upper corner of the screen. And you see that there are a bunch of tabs there where the one that says global now is highlighted. And next to it are config, remote, and network. And those four tabs are not accessible from the iPad in the iPad app. All of the other functions of the console, as near as I can tell, are in that. But these things set up the console fundamental parameters, like whether it's 48 meg sample rate or 44.1, whether the sync is coming from internal to the console or from the AES50 ports or from the card, some other things in there. And as we, I think I'm scrolling through all of these. Nope, we're jumping to the network tab, which is the relevant one to us. And you see there in the top, the 192.168.20 is the same as what we saw before. And I'm using the 30.36 as the name of this console or the IP address for this console. And then the same things under subnet mask as I showed you before. And I've seen gateway be set before, but I've never found any reason. Mine all work on 0000.
It's the same thing as the router on the iPad, Dan.
Interesting. I don't have to set this to 10. So there you go. If you wanted to do DHCP, you push the knobs at the bottom that you see at the very bottom of the screen there are both scrolling. You rotate them to scroll from one thing to another, and you push to select. And if you push the bottom left knob, that changes it into DHCP, and all this stuff disappears, I think. So that's that. So what I try to do is to put my console, tablet, and router in sequence so that the consoles I generally have from 0.11, 192.1.168.20.11 to whatever is consoles. Tablets are in the 20s, 0.21s, and the routers are 0.51 and above. And that keeps two things from being on the same number for the most part, like the printer and the Yamaha console that I showed you that before. Computers, I think, have 0.1 to 0.10 reserved for their use. So I think my kid told me that. And I don't really care. I don't use those. So, and here's what I meant about setting the numbers one different. If you have two consoles and you set one to be 0.11 and one to be 0.2, then when you connect with your tablet to both of them, you can just change the 0.1 or the last digit from a 1 to a 2 or a 2 to a 1 and connect. If the router is connected to both of them, you can do that. If you want to connect to two different routers, just change the last digit on the tablet and you'll can jump to that. That's all I'm trying to show there. Any more questions, comments?
Just maybe a term clarification of terminology. So there's the routers, hubs, and switches, and most of what your this type of network is using is just getting the packets around, and that's a hub or a switch will do that. So that Netgear, that blue Netgear metal box that you showed earlier, just a hub or a switch that just sends the packets around.
But it doesn't send them. It doesn't send them through the air.
No, it just the confusion comes is that it's routing the packets to different places. But a router is a more complex device that was doing what the other gentleman was explaining earlier, where it translates them to go onto the internet.
What term would I use to indicate that I'm using only the Wi-Fi capacity of this thing plus a single connection to connect to the device that I want to connect to?
I think that's called a bridge.
An access point.
Or a bridge.
Yeah, it's just something that converts the wireless to Wi-Fi or Wi-Fi to wired. That's what an access point does.
Yeah.
So basically an access point is the wireless equivalent of a hub or switch wired.
But it wouldn't be accurate to call Airport Express or a Linksys 4,500 or whatever this thing is, an access point, would it? It's more complex than that.
Well, so an Airport Express is basically in one box, a switch, an access point, and a router all combined.
Okay.
You're not using the router functionality of your airport.
Okay.
You're just using the access point and the switch.
Okay. But I need a separate switch in order for it to work with the console.
Dan, this is Lou again. That's a issue only with the Airport Expresses that need the switch in between. Mm-hmm. That was a problem I ran into when I used Airport Express as well. Any other access point doesn't need that.
Okay. Okay, cool.
John Kasperk has got a couple points here. The numbering on the last number is not predefined. You can choose a range for devices any way you want.
Correct.
I got that out of what you said. And then also freely available local IP nets use 192.166.x.x or 10.x.x.x. AP includes a bridge function by its functional definition.
168
access point.
Say that again. You got cut off.
Steve, what'd you say?
Bill, you said 166. It's 168.
Oh, there you go. 168. It's old eyes.
No, whoever said that AP, that's access point, has a bridge in it.
Okay.
But you can get a Wi-Fi, a Wi-Fi Ethernet with a single Ethernet jack, but you need either an access point that has multiple, like four jacks, Ethernet jacks to run more than one console, one more than one mixer, or you need a bridge with an Ethernet jack and then a switch. The switch gives you multiple, it's like a breakout box. It gives you multiple Ethernet jacks from one or from a one Wi-Fi radio to several Ethernet jacks, which you need at least four probably.
Okay, great. This is a great conversation. Thanks, you guys. Yeah.
Basically, what I've got on the D-Life is an edge router, which has been made into just a switch, and then the Ubiquiti transmitter thing, which is acting as the access point, the bridge over to being a Wi-Fi, chucking out the Wi-Fi. And it's got something like 10 ports on it, and we use those for wireless anything.
Mm-hmm.
We've got quite often we're controlling the lighting desk when somebody's running around, placing the lights and stuff like that. It'll not be the first time I've been controlling Dante, the control network of Dante, at the same time as I've got the D-Live stuff all running as well.
Through the same device? Dante and other stuff through the same device?
Just the Dante control, not the Dante data. Not the audio data, just the Dante control. But you turn up the gain on the Rio or whatever. Mm-hmm. The last time we had running, there was a CL5 out front, and I had the D-Live on stage. Mm-hmm. And the guy, my Ubiquitis are wiping out the little Linksys router, so we just plugged the control data through my thing, and it worked fine. There was no real issues.
Awesome. Okay.
All right, Dan. Dwayne Asperg says static IP means the console will always have the same address and is easily connected to easily connected from the tablet. If you use DHCP, the console could end up with a different IP address next time you turn things on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Oh, and what one thing to mention about all of that is with DHCP, you do need a router, or at least any home routers will incorporate a DHCP server. If you just wanted to go the access point / switch route, you would have to have static IP addresses, because generally you wouldn't have a DHCP server on your network then.
Okay. I got to confess, this makes my head hurt, all of this stuff. And I do the best I can, and then I stop.